Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Birkin bag stuffed in the bottom of your closet, dusty from disuse, of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. Budget's broken, politics broken, spirit broken, soul not broken. We're going to talk about Beyoncé's Renaissance today. It's been out, depending on what your relationship to the dark web is, it's been out somewhere between 48 and 96 hours. We've been absorbing it all. It's a family reunion. We got a big house today, and we're gonna get into all aspects and angles of it. Wesley Morris is here. Wesley, hello.
Hey.
Wesley wrote the review of the album. It's already online. If you haven't read it, just press pause, go read it. And then if you feel like you need more, we'll be here. It is a dynamic and incredibly written review. Please go absorb that. John Perelis is here. JP, what's good?
I'm here.
JP, we saw briefly when we were on cameras on, we saw you wearing a pattern shirt today, and we're grateful for it, and we know it's in the spirit of the conversation.
Absolutely.
That's correct. Salamisha Till is here. Salamisha.
Hey, how are you? I'm excited to be here.
First of all, quick pause. Two Pulitzer Prize winners on podcast. Oh, wait, oh. I'm sorry. Wait.
Thank you. Woo! This is so exciting. Thank you.
That's extremely exciting. Salamisha, the most recent winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and also teaches a class on Beyoncé, among other things. So we'll get a little academic angle as well. Joe Coscarelli is here. Joe, what's up, boo?
How you doing? I'm here.
I'm excited. Before we get in to some of the bigger picture stuff, can we just do a quick roundtable roll call of a favorite song and maybe just like a couple sentences as to why? I'm happy to start since this is my invention.
Okay.
So give everybody a little bit of time. First of all, there are probably three or four that are vying for contention at the moment. I gravitated to Thick really quickly. I gravitated to Cozy really quickly. Two of like the much more explicit dance floor oriented, hard production songs. But I think after a few listens, what I find myself leaning into is Plastic Off the Sofa.
Boy, I love that you can't help but be yourself around me. Yourself around me. Sugar. When you're tripping, I know I make up, they make love. So I let you be. I let you be. It's the way you listen when I'm crying.
I was jotting notes as I was listening a few different times, and I kept kind of coming back. I was like, is she on her Denise Williams here? Like, what's going on? Reaching back to a particular kind of like luxurious but sweet era of soul music that's kind of just after disco, but kind of before the kind of thickness of what we later think of as mid to late 80s R&B. It's both kind of like naive and sensual all at once. It's coming right after Church Girl, which obviously is an interesting juxtaposition of the erotic and the kind of holy. But Plastic Off the Sofa, to me, it's where the album starts to cool off and gel just a tiny bit and also pivot. The second half does feel a little bit different than the first half. So that's where I'm going. Who wants to jump in?
I'll go. It's Wesley. I definitely love Plastic Off the Sofa, having listened to it only maybe four times. I would say that the song that I'm looking forward to getting to know a lot better is All Up in Your Mind.
I really love you.
I just think there's a lot of risk to be had here. And I didn't really know how to explore this in the space that I had in trying to write about my feelings, thoughts in the review. But a lot of things came to mind in terms of when things like this don't work. Like, I really wanted that last Gaga record to be this. I mean, obviously it can't be because it's Beyonce and Gaga's Gaga, but like Gaga's version of this might be art pop. I don't know. But there's something about a song like All Up In Your Mind that is just, it could have just been a straight pop song, would have sounded really delicious. But there's so much static friction, resistance, subversion happening in what is also kind of a straight ahead thing. And she just really has such a command of what the dynamics are for a song like that to be interesting. She embraces and luxuriates in that weirdness. This is a weird record, album. The album is weird.
We definitely have to talk about the intersection of ambition and weirdness, because I think that they coexist in a very specific way on this record, but we'll get to that. JP, where are you at on songs?
It may be because it's the one I've been listening to longest, but Break My Soul still gets me.
Yep.
There's so much going on in that song. There's just that simple two-chord thing they got from Robin S. But then every iteration of it, there's another little instrument creeping in. And there's also the combination of the personal and the larger perspective in this song. She's both sleeping good at night and she's building a foundation. She's looking beyond herself in this song, and yet it's a total dance floor banger. The other one that I'm learning to get inside is Move, which has Grace Jones, you know, godmother, and Tems from Nigeria, her Afrobeat sister. I love the beat. It feels like it's from South Africa and Nigeria, and it feels good. And it's got that total subterranean bass slink that is just pure sensual pleasure.
Break My Soul, obviously, is what we were listening to at the beginning of the episode, and I'm sure we've all been listening to for a month ad nauseum. Salamisha, what are you thinking?
I really do like Move. I also really like Grace Jones. So I think it was really exciting, and we can talk about this more, obviously, but just Beyonce is often someone who knows the archive and knows the traditions, the various traditions, Black musical traditions so well. So just to have Grace Jones like literally recording alongside her was really important. But I also think that kind of aesthetic is why I'm drawn to Alien Superstar, because when I heard Alien Superstar, I'm like, oh, she's doing Grace Jones. Unique. That's what you are. Stilettos kicking vintage crystal off the bar. Category bad bitch. I'm the bar. Alien superstar. Whip, whip. I'm too classy for this world. Forever I'm that girl. Beat you diamonds and pearl. Oh baby. I live in Newark and my sister lives in Chicago. So house is really this idea of a renaissance is really interesting because there's like a house festival every weekend here in Newark. And so so it was kind of cool. I was happy to hear artists that I'm familiar with or that are beloved, like Foremost Poets, Moonraker, on Alien Superstar, just to like give a little love to the places where house has continues to thrive and doesn't necessarily need a renaissance, but it's nice to have this music circulating in such a different way, I suppose, right now. And then I really like Church Girl, because I find it for Beyonce to do a song like Church Girl. I'm not a church girl, but I was a good girl. And so there's an overlap, right? And it starts off with the sisters, the high priestesses of gospel music in many ways. And then she makes a shift to from the sacred to the sexual.
Drop it like a thotty.
if there's anything on this album that is important, is that it's a very wet album. And I think we should talk about what that wetness means and all the variations of permutations of wetness that the body can elicit.
Oh my God.
But I'm like, it's a wet. Yes. And that's it. I'll say Virgo's groove, because I know we have a Leo who has a birthday tomorrow, but I actually was listening to it right before, and the ending of that song and just this kind of repetition of her love is just really beautiful. And I'm a Virgo, so we can talk about what the astrological impulses of this, what's going on astrologically here, I think is important too. So I'll put those songs out there.
Joe, where are you at?
I need your help, guys. I want to be really real here, and I want a little bit of a diagnosis. I think this maybe says a lot about me, or says a lot about where I am at this moment in my life. I really like the songs on this album that sound the most organic, that sound the most throwbacky. I can't get into the futuristic stuff. I'm a honey. I'm not a pure. I know there's throwback in all of this, but to me, like, when Honey finally hit, you know, the second half of track 15, I was like, and I felt like I could exhale. So just taking it from that, I like Cuff It. I like Plastic Off the Sofa. I like Virgo's Groove. I like Church Girl. I like those songs that feel the least. I'm at the skating rink. I'm not at the club. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I mean, just going back. So before the album, we did this little roundtable. What do we think Beyoncé's definitive album is? And I picked 4. And I think that shows which version of Beyoncé I like. And the songs I just named are probably the ones that would be most at home.
The Love on Topest.
The Love on, yeah, that those are the songs that would have fit in her career maybe 10 years ago to some extent. And I'm just wondering what this says about me other than that I'm white and that I'm straight.
That's okay. Deep.
Look, I'm in my feelings. What can I say? I need your help.
I like how this turned into a call-in show.
Yeah. Was that too real for the first 10 minutes of the episode?
No. I think it's perfect, actually. I think it's perfect. And I think what's perfect about it is I think that one of the beautiful things about this album is it's identifiably moving in blocks of ideas, but there's also a seamlessness to it. But there's no denying that for about 4 consecutive songs, the idea has shifted into something more traditional from both a production standpoint and from a musical history standpoint. Like, not even traditional, just older.
You're talking about the middle run, Wesley?
I'm talking about, yeah, from, I would say, Energy is sort of a, I don't know what to do with Energy, but from like Cuff It, Break My Soul, Church Girl, Plastic Off the Sofa, Virgo's Groove. There's a Marvin Gaye song in there. Marvin Gaye as an idea is interesting here. That period in the late 70s, early 80s, when everything was just like candy on a stick. Just the pure, like, deliciousness of some of those songs. And part of what makes them delicious is they're so familiar in this interpolated way. So you can't get back to the place they're coming from. It's a classic nostalgia engine without itself being explicitly about nostalgia.
Can I ask a philosophical question? Because I think to kind of expand on what Joe was asking, which is there are some artists that I think we look towards to be relentlessly modern, always of the now and of the tomorrow. I don't know if Beyoncé necessarily is in that space. I feel like she could function in that space, but also function more how Joe is talking about in terms of being reverent and mindful of history. And I think Salamisha, when you use the word archive and her awareness of the archive, that's so real. This is a archival record in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't know if you guys have sat reading the credits at all, like just as text.
Of course we have.
I'm just saying, they are fascinating. They are fascinating. Liddell Townsend and MTF? What? Anyway, sidebar. Point being, do we think that Beyoncé is obliged to make a modern record? Is that something that she has to do? Like some other artists maybe have to do in order to maintain relevance? Or does her power and her relevance exist somewhere outside of making the new, quote unquote, in heavy quote marks.
I had a class called From Bessie Smith to Beyonce. And then I taught another class on Lemonade 444 and A Seat at the Table. And one of the things that I find so exciting about Beyonce, I've always found, and this is why I kind of wish she did interviews, because I really would like to ask her these questions, but you know, what happens there. So, but I always open with this segment that she did at the Grammys. I think it was Tina Turner was going to get an award, and she opens and she does this dance routine. And in this opening, she's paying homage to obviously Tina Turner, but Lena Horne, to Ella Fitzgerald. And she moves so seamlessly between these figures in this one moment. And so I've always been, like I said, the archive, but I've always been interested in the way in which she calls upon all of these like historical moments and these historical figures, kind of embodies them, pays homage, and then makes a turn, right? And so whether that's like, really, we could think about it as sampling turned as a kind of practice, right? The practice of sampling becoming the dominant aesthetic or something of an album. Maybe that's what it is. But she's so like thoughtful and so conscientious. She's the one artist who I think has invoked Aretha, has invoked Josephine Baker, has invoked Grace Jones. I mean, like, there's no contemporary artist who's done that. And then also she'll do other figures as well. Prince, right? So there's no artist, I think, who has been able, just before this album, has been able to summon up, conjure up all these artists, these histories in one performance or on an album. So I think, like, she doesn't get her credit for just being able to popularize the Black musical archive the way that she does. Sometimes she gets critiqued a lot for misuses or not citing properly, but I think she never gets the full credit for having that historical knowledge and then putting it into song form. And I think her last three albums, Lemonade, the album Black is King, and then now we have Renaissance, is really just saying, this is what I'm going to be doing in different ways.
Also the Coachella performance, Homecoming.
And the Coachella, exactly.
Frankly, this album, Renaissance, reminded me the most of Homecoming. It reminded me of being
totally
at Coachella, and just every 15 seconds, a new pivot, a new juxtaposition, a new insertion, a new illusion, and you almost can't keep up. And it's funny because I feel like every now and again when credits on a record get put out, like a record like this, a big pop record, you get this kind of a streak of discourse on Twitter where it's like, can you believe these songs have 17 songwriters and 4 producers and so on? Like this kind of like very short-sighted critique. And I look at these credits and I get excited. I'm like, damn right, there's 17 songwriters. Do you know how much history is embedded in these songs?
I was going to say, it's like a reading list at the end of a book, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Totally.
Exactly. Yeah. Effing right. So people should be pumped about that.
Even the stuff that I'm saying sounds futuristic is also reaching back. So that's why I say also organic. There are some songs on this album with live instrumentation or instrumentation that sounds live and some without. But the futuristic stuff is reaching back as much as the openly backward looking stuff, which is pretty amazing. And I think she's become, especially even since Coachella and in the little, she's done a little bit more explaining with this album, both putting out the single and just these little statements here and there on Instagram or on her website. And I think she's being more and more explicit that what I'm doing is lifting up the archive.
Well, it's also archaeological. I mean, you get all these layers. It's like digging through Troy.
Yep.
And so she's making all of these connections. I mean, African-American culture is filled with ancestor worship. The amazing thing about Beyonce is she's good enough to embody Lena Horne and Josephine Baker and Donna Summer and Grace Jones. And she's got that much skill, that much talent, and she's willing to use it. But also just like the crate digging on this album is insane. There are songs here that are not on title, like the Princess Loco sample at the beginning of I'm That Girl. She's really gone deep, she or her producers, but presumably she is the controlling choice for every note on this album. And there's so much amazing, manipulated, found, changed, recontextualized stuff. It's really impressive.
Can I ask a question here? Since we're in the land of illusion and philosophy at this point, in history, pop music history, I thought a lot about what and how to articulate this difference between what Beyonce is doing and what a person like Madonna does. There's some clear one-to-one musical structure relationships here that, I mean, I'm sure nobody, I can't say I'm sure nobody was thinking about in the formation of these songs and the assemblage of this album. But it's interesting to think about the ways in which some of this sort of overarching formal things that Beyoncé has been doing for the last few years, you know, it's a different university, but it's the same kind of higher education that a person like Madonna has been interested in for a long time. The problems are different, obviously. There are all kinds of American popular culture, historical things with Madonna. But the fact of the matter is, her project, when it comes to American pop history, she's a student. And, you know, I think she would fancy herself a teacher in some ways, but I think primarily her studentness comes through on a lot of those really good and some of the mediocre records too. And I think that her affinities for gay music, Black music, and the people who make it and the people who listen to it and dance to it is sustaining for her. We can call her a vampire if we feel so inclined. I'm not of the Madonna is a vampire world, but I'm definitely open to having those conversations. I don't know. I just wanted to just bring that into the room.
I wanted to ask you guys about this too, because I feel that Beyoncé as collagist, Beyoncé as student and teacher, when I think of the other sort of A-list collage artists, right? Drake, Kanye, guys who are also reaching into specifically different eras of Black music and regional Black music, but even someone like Rosalía, you know, who has this year that I hear a lot
of
Motomami in the construction of this. We had a podcast about this previously, but those three people I mentioned who I think are also operating at this high of a level, just in terms of being fans and students of music, I think Beyoncé's borrowing, or whatever you want to call it, is received more open heartedly, but tell me if you think I'm wrong.
That's
I think those three people I named, and I'm interested because Salamisha, you said that Beyoncé has faced a lot of criticism for the way she has borrowed in the past. And I, just from where I'm sitting, feel like she is hailed for it almost universally from the way I see it. And whereas those people I feel like have faced much more criticism over the course of their careers for doing this sort of collage. And I wonder if the answer is just talent, that she's the most talented of the bunch, and that's why she gets away with it the most. Or maybe she doesn't at all.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the controversies, and these may be like, they don't necessarily rise to the level of other controversies, usually because it's kind of like a one-to-one corollary. Like, so if you think about the Grammys, another Grammys performance, when Ledisi performs, you know, she plays Mahalia in Selma, and then Beyoncé actually sings, she's embodying Mahalia Jackson in many ways on stage at the Grammys before I think John Legend and Common perform their song from Selma. So there will be these moments, it's kind of like the Khalees controversy, these moments in which there's a kind of one-to-one corollary in which Beyoncé may take up, there's other Black women are erased to make space for Beyoncé. Or the most famous, I guess, would be when the inauguration happened and she sings Etta James, right? So Etta James calls her out because she's alive still. So why is At Last being performed at this sacrosanct moment when the Obamas are doing their first dance at the inauguration, the People's Ball, I think. So those are the most obvious and most sustained kinds of criticisms I've noticed with Beyoncé in terms of appropriation, people who are alive who are not being recognized for their work. But you're right, she doesn't get that sustained ongoing critique of cultural appropriation. This album to me seems to be one that is marked by deep generosity. And so I was interested to follow in a different way of Wesley's question. Like, when you have such a deep citation, like when you have so many people listed in terms of the credits, I think that's like a spirit of collaboration. It's a way of thinking about coalitions moving across time. But I also wonder, and this is, I think, what you were mentioning, John, there's a sense that the solo artist, the solo male genius artist is like, that's the person that everyone should be aspiring to. And Beyoncé never really gets to be put in that category fully because I think she's never seen as the primary producer or the only producer. But to me, this collaboration is really deep and significant, specifically in this moment that we're living in, where we need coalitions and we need to move across different categories and to create a sense of unity. So I was just wondering about this idea of the very lengthy credit listing, if that takes away, or to me, that just marks her intentionality and generosity in a different way.
It's an enhancement.
Yeah,
I would say.
I agree. And frankly, I say that also coming from a place of, frankly, being deeply cynical about how songwriting credits have evolved in the last few years. And this has come up in a couple of cases already with the Beyoncé record. One, the issue with Robin S., or not the issue, but the interpolation of Robin S.'s Show Me Love on Break My Soul, which I have to say, when Break My Soul first came out, I was a little bit like, I don't totally hear it, but in the context of the album, and especially with the intro section of the song on the album, it's very crisp and clear, and I think absolutely earned as far as a credit goes. And then in the issue with the Khalees interpolation, which led to a whole kind of domino effect of Khalees speaking out initially against what was seen as a collaboration, but is in fact interpolation, but ultimately turned into a conversation about ownership, the nature of Khalees' relationship with the Neptunes and Pharrell Williams, et cetera, et cetera. But that interpolation, quote unquote, I thought was very, very casual. And I didn't know where to fall. And I'm actually curious where y'all stand on this. Was that credit given as a nod, as an homage, even though Khalees herself would not receive any of the financial benefit from it? Or is it Beyoncé knows that she'll be sued by anyone who thinks that she has used their work without permission, and therefore it's a preemptive, cynical maneuver? I didn't quite know. The Robin S. thing, I totally understood. The Khalees thing, as far as the choice to give credit up front, I felt unsure about after listening to it a few times.
Can I give a little bit of a timeline on the Khalees thing? Because I think a lot of the online chatter stemmed from initial misinformation about what was going to be
right,
on the album.
Because the credits came out before the song.
Right. So, I mean, and this was very interesting in terms of Beyoncé giving credit to the artists she was collaborating with, sampling and interpolating, and the way that this was confused online. Because I believe what happened was credits may have gone up on Apple initially before the album. It has been claimed that they were up temporarily, and then they were circulated by a Beyoncé fan page. They were written up in, you know, the official Renaissance font and made into a graphic and circulated that way. Those credits have since changed. They weren't perfectly accurate for the album as it was released, but that sort of got the thing rolling. And then a day or two later, there was news that the Khalees song that was sampled was, I forget even which one it was, but it was not Milkshake, which ended up being the one that was interpolated. I think based on those conversations, people first thought it was definitely going to be a sample. They thought it was going to be a sample of a lesser known Khalees song. And I think they thought it was going to include Khalees' vocals, which would be a totally different thing. What ended up happening was that A, it was Milkshake, and B, it was musical, right? It was from The Groove, created by the Neptunes, who are collaborators elsewhere on this album. So they're essentially crediting themselves for a groove they created. And then Khalees came out and said, I didn't have any songwriting credits on these Neptunes tracks. Pharrell never wrote a lyric, never wrote a song in his life. I think what she meant is he never wrote a top line. He never came up with lyrics. And that's not what ended up on the album. So I think there was a lot of misinformation that all fed into this larger issue. And then, John, you're right, the conversation became, why didn't Khalees have credits on her first couple albums that she made with the Neptunes? But all of which is to say, I think the way the internet works and the way incomplete information travels sort of created a brouhaha that never needed to exist, especially because I just don't hear Milkshake in Energy.
Let's listen to the part of Energy from Renaissance that seems to be nodding to Milkshake, and then we'll be back in just a minute. Come lit still, I drop lazy. None of that may be energy. Energy. Energy.
Just 5:45. Don't get out of line. Yeah. Ooh, 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 ooh. Pick a side.
Did you know the average child spends less than 10 minutes a day playing outside? Trust for Public Land is working with local communities nationwide to connect more people to the outdoors. Our community schoolyards projects give kids and communities access to the Mother Nature-approved play spaces they need. This Earth Month, take action to create cool, green, climate-resilient playgrounds fit for the future. Join the movement to bring the outdoors to more people across the country at tpl.org/earthmonth. That's tpl.org/earthmonth.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
So this is, of course, a podcast hobby course, a perfect distillation of what happens when people armed with incomplete information make extremely loud arguments. And it's it is a challenging environment for pure factual conversation to happen. However, that said, it did, the domino effect of this, I think, did lead to some interesting directions. And I kind of wonder what the behind scenes conversations right now between Khalees's people and Pharrell's people, not to say nothing of Khalees and Beyonce. Khalees and Pharrell had, if you all read the stories from 2002 and 2003, you understand the relationship that Khalees and Pharrell had for many years. It seemed like it ended poorly and there is ongoing bad blood. And that is part of what has been unearthed here, catching a stray from the Renaissance rollout.
I'm still recovering from Wanderland, frankly.
Who amongst us is not?
I mean, we don't even need to get into that.
Khalees, hell of a talent, Khalees.
Yeah. What happened to that album just feels like somewhat tragic to me. But I also think that what is happening here, and I'm gonna just credit Beyonce as being a broker of this larger ethical and moral and industrial problem when it comes to credit.
So you're not cynical about this?
Oh, no.
You don't read it as cynicism.
I don't know where, I would not know where to begin to apply the cynicism, right? Because it's not as though Beyonce just discovered that people will be coming for her and the way she's approached her project when it comes to credits either given or seemingly elided. Where is her scratch paper? Show us the receipts. We've got receipts. Where are yours? You know, all of that stuff. She's not new to that. I think she knows what the stakes are when it comes to releasing this stuff into the world.
A lot of lawyers, a lot of Parkwood lawyers.
Sure. But again, I mean, I know those things exist. I know that's a heavy dimension of what we're talking about. But I think that the thing that I'm interested in is why aren't these singers credited as authors of these songs? I think that there's something. There's no way you can tell me, no matter what I'm hearing when I hear Show Me Love, all I know is that what I'm waiting for is that growl at the beginning of that record. And that's not a thing you write down. Doesn't go in any bar. But that to me is such a flex of authorship. This has been my Whitney Houston argument for eons. Somebody has to sing. Somebody has to figure out how to sing these songs. And I think there might be a version of the world where Beyonce is not responsible for any of the lyrics. Let's just say that's the case, right? She's not responsible for any of the writing of the songs. She doesn't like have any idea what this music is. But to listen to her sing this music, that would be authorship, no matter what her involvement is in the song structure, the chord progressions, the instruments chosen to express this music. And I think that is a thing that needs to be addressed across the industry. Because the other thing is the losers in these scenarios, always women, but especially Black women, who are brought in to add flavor, spice, authenticity, realness, never get credit, never get that money when it's time for residuals and royalties. And that is a thing that has deep historical roots and needs to be addressed because to me, it makes no sense.
I think that's why you see Beyonce now and Mariah going back. They're always in the publishing whether or not, like you said, we don't know what exactly their role is in writing the lyrics or the top line melodies, but they make sure they're in there because they certainly change how the song's created.
We teach a history of Black women musicians. This is like the one of the dominant tensions, right? Like this question of authorship versus ownership and who gets credit, who gets compensated. And so the other thing I was thinking about, what's interesting about the Khalees controversy, of course, it's not necessarily Beyonce's place to respond, but it is the Neptune's place to respond. And so the other word that could be floating around here is, what does it mean to really have reparations? What does it mean to have these artists get credit, or these artists be their important place in the American music canon really be recognized? And so it's been interesting to watch all the other artists who've been really thankful and grateful, like the Clark sisters, who are, like I mentioned before, on Church Girl, or even obviously Donna Summer. And then the thing about Grace Jones is interesting is that in her memoir, she talked about Beyonce being someone who was just imitating her. And so to see Grace Jones be interpolated quite literally in this space is another way of compensating for that labor, for that innovation, and for that practice. So to me, that's what I meant by like the collaboration. This is a very generous album in the spirit of Beyonce both trying to give back, but also look back. The other thing I was thinking about too with this album is this idea of freedom. And so I'm like a weird, like, I'm not like the best dancer, but when I dance to house, I'm like, I'm a pretty good dancer. But I'm dancing to house, I feel like I gotta like, just, you gotta let go. You gotta like really fully just move to whatever sounds you're hearing. And it's the freest I am kinesthetically or on the dance floor. And so there's and she talks about like freedom, not trying to be perfect, being in quarantine and all of us trying to imagine what was on the horizon. And so this album comes from that place. And what does it mean that Beyonce, because what we're talking about with Khalees is someone who has alleged to be exploited. And then you have Beyonce as probably, I would say, hands down, the most powerful and probably compensated Black woman performer in history. And so that's a really important mark, I think, for Beyonce in our culture, but also how does she use that? How does she wield that power, and how does she wield that pen? And then here we have this really thoughtful attempt to connect to audiences and communities that she both identifies with and also is outside of. And so I don't know. I just really like, I just want to use generosity as like a good thing that I think this album produces. And we still haven't talked about sex, which I don't know if we're going to get to.
No, or, I think let's get to it right now. Yeah. But can I just make one additional note on what you just said, which is you're talking about generosity and compensation. When you think about, not to be so mundane, and Joe, maybe you can talk a little bit more about like who makes money, how that gets split out. But when you have credits like this, when you have multiple songwriters, when you have multiple producers, this is not Beyonce being sort of the auteur and saying, all of your labor has belonged to me. This is quite the opposite. This is a true splitting of the pie. I don't know what the splits are on each song. Obviously, I can't get into the pennies and the micro pennies. But what this is saying, and I think part of that generosity comes from being, frankly, very famous and very wealthy already. What you can do is you can make a record that's a big, ambitious record and know that you can basically redistribute the wealth that's going to come in off of this album to the influences, to the co-writers, to the sample sources, et cetera, et cetera. That's how I read it.
Prayers out to the managers and the lawyers doing the splits on this album, because that's that seems like months, if not years, of work. So hopefully everybody is getting paid in a timely manner.
I agree. So Anisha, you want to pick up on the wet?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in terms of this being a dance album and, you know, what does it mean conceptually? Part of me wanted to like move songs around, but then I felt like I couldn't, because like that's going against the whole spirit of the album, but also this against the spirit of the dance floor and like this transitions between one song to the other. And obviously many people have made allusions to this being like a DJ set, and the flow is meant for you to move and cool down and then get back up and all that stuff. So I want to say the wetness I was speaking of was both sweat, but also just this Beyonce increasingly becoming more and more open with her own eroticism, right? And so she's obviously always been a sexualized and sexual personality and persona. But here I feel like we're getting to new territory with a song like Thick in particular, where there's a clear gender fluidity that she is embodying and she's also claiming, which is not necessarily how we think of Beyoncé's sexuality. Obviously, she appeals to many, but her gaze that she usually sort of seems to be appealing, personally appealing to maybe, you know, a heteronormative one. But here I feel like we got a lot of stuff going on and it's really kind of nice and liberating and exciting and wet in all the ways in which people can be wet, I think is really a good way of thinking about this album. It's so sexy to me. And I think
I agree.
That's really important.
Does this shift feel post Savage Remix, post Megan Thee Stallion? Is that because I feel like even I'm hearing that in some of the lyrics, and maybe some of the only moments where I kind of get knocked off the center of the record is, and I say this as an older person that sometimes uses younger slang, but every now and again, there'll be just a phrase that's like incredibly au courant or extremely young. And you're like, it feels like you're being jolted into like an alternate Beyoncé for a moment before kind of going back. But I do feel like that comfort that you're describing does feel maybe post-Savage, the success of that record, Beyoncé's flexibility in terms of subject matter, also the rapping singing axis, like being much more comfortable with whether it's straight rapping or talk singing, I guess would be the way to think about it. This comes up on Alien Superstar for me, especially like the declarative stuff towards the end. We think of Beyoncé as someone who's extremely versatile in terms of a relationship to the archive of Black music history, but there's also a recent archive, a perpetually evolving now, a TikTok present. And Beyoncé is also asserting her place in that conversation. And that is fascinating to me because plenty of people would just ignore that in favor of yesteryear. But she's not doing that.
The question of the modern, actually, this is probably where it comes in, like this way in which she, because it's part of like a milieu or a moment. I've been watching Rap-ish as well as Everything is Trash too, right? And so there's a break, a generational break in which there's, and everyone talks about this all the time, so I'm not saying anything new, but the freedom, the sexual fluidity, the kind of owning of one's sexuality unabashedly and unapologetically alongside one's Blackness. We have all of this going on. And I think you're right to point that this is a modern Beyoncé sexually, speaking to multiple generations, but a different generation. And yet she's also archival, right? She's going back to a Black queer past from the 1970s and 80s. So it's both modern and also retro. And so this seeking of sexual freedom, I think, is really important to mark today, but also she's pulling from Black queer spaces, Black queer communities that were innovative in the 70s and 80s. And I think it's glorious. So I'm just effusive about all of the stuff. So I don't, you know.
that's jumping right into the 2000s and 2010s. I mean, the Kevin Avion sample, you know, Down on Pure/Honey. Yeah, all of that.
I have a tangent for you.
Go in.
Yes, please.
I think Beyoncé's songwriting strategy changed from pop to hip hop radically with Beyoncé. You go from put a ring on it. Mm-hmm. You go from like sloganeering straightforward pop lyrics to annotated on genius.com lyrics. And it goes with her increasing dive into the archive, and it goes with her increasing ambition, and it goes with her being beyond chasing radio hits. And I think on the last four albums, you need your decoder ring.
Yeah, there's a lot of J in here, right? Like, people don't want to hear that, but like, there's a lot of J flow. Like, there's a lot of J. Like his flows are here, his slang is here, his phrasing is here.
Basquiat's off the wall.
He's in the credits. And I think two of Beyoncé's most consistent collaborators over the stretch between Lemonade to here are The Dream and Jay-Z. And I think that you hear those guys in this. But I also want to take the question of the queerness of the lyrics and the sexual liberation and hear more from you guys about that. Because I wonder, like, is there any part of you that feels that this is appropriative? Because I can only go off of like online chatter and the essays that have been written so far. And I see a lot of Black lesbians, especially, embracing this. You have a writing credit for Sid of the Internet on Plastic Off the Sofa. Like, she's tapping the right collaborators. But also Beyoncé has been a symbol of heteronormativity in a lot of ways, right? She loves talking about gender roles, specifically traditional gender roles. And at her critical peak, before this, for Lemonade, that's as heteronormative as it gets, a sort of scorned woman narrative. So I'm interested what you guys think about the way she's sort of fully embraced this queer Black past, present, and future more so than she ever has.
I want to bring up a thread that I came across. Actually, it was an Instagram story thread from @iHeartErica talking about Beyoncé as a cis straight woman and relationship to ballroom culture. And should this person be the person who is poised to potentially profit culturally and economically off of the embrace of ballroom culture that you have on this record? Now, obviously, Mike Q is sampled on this record, Kevin Avion, so on and so forth. It's not as if the wealth is not being spread, but that line of questioning, I think, is out there. I haven't read a bunch of pieces along those lines, but I did see that conversation starting to happen.
Madonna was there first.
I don't know if that makes it better.
Yeah, and yes. Still gets fished for it, right? Which yes. I think is part of what yes. Wesley was alluding to earlier.
Well, I think she does an important move by establishing lineage with her uncle, right? So she establishes a kind of familial tradition with, and I think that's genuine. I'm not going to be skeptical and say that was just to stave off questions of appropriation or critiques of appropriation. I think that she's saying this is in a way, if I'm not necessarily, this is not who I am, but this is part of me. And so this is, I think, one way, you know, of all the musical traditions that she grew up with, listening to, was exposed to, this is also hers to claim. I think that's what she's doing there by establishing that kind of biological genealogy. But the other thing I think that's interesting is, I mean, this is Beyoncé's fan base is very, like, this is her fan base. And so I think she's also, when she has the with her liner notes, that she loves them deep. She loves all of us deep and who it's for. I guess is it appropriation or is it an invitation? This is a gift to people who have been so loyal and faithful to me as fans. So it's a question, but people do seem to be very excited about it. I also wanted to say to our other point about Black women as contributors to this album, Nova Wave, the duo produced about half of the songs. Black women make up about like 1%. I saw some art, 1% of production teams in the country. And so for her to have these two Black women as part of really shaping this album in really profound ways, I think is another way in which she's trying to say something in the production, in the credits, in the collaboration that I think is important and part of the openness of this album. So if it's an open sound, she's also trying to make these kind of really deep collaborations quite structurally on the album too. But this question of appropriation and Madonna versus Beyoncé, I think is important. So I don't want to get us away from it. I just think she's could stave it off a little bit differently than Madonna was able to or has been able to, perhaps.
Your framing of kind of appropriation versus invitation, I mean, I think obviously, we could talk about Madonna coming from a very different place when she made the choices that she made in the late 80s versus what Beyoncé is doing now. I feel like the origin points feel very different. But I also think that idea is probably a helpful idea for us to be using more broadly, not simply when we're talking about Beyoncé and ballroom culture. Or I think the idea of appropriation has come to feel increasingly narrow and constricted and makes the hybridity that underlies so much of popular music, obviously in relation to prevailing power structures, but still that hybridity, it's harder to talk about when it's all channeled through one term and one framing. And the idea of appropriation versus imitation, it feels more generative to me in that you all of a sudden you have an arc of ideas, an arc of concept where you can place people on. And that's something that I think we should be keeping an eye on and an ear on. In the bigger picture, not simply here.
Can I just take everything that we've all been talking about and add another frame to it that I think is really important? When I turned 40, I felt like... Am I getting applause for
yes.
making it to 40? When I turned 40, I did not appreciate the degree to which I had been miserable from like 37 or 36 to 39, getting to 40. And there was something really interestingly psychic to me about shedding a kind of heaviness that I didn't even appreciate was there until it was gone. And some of that was just this moment where I realized I'm the youngest old person now. And that felt liberating. And I felt like once I crossed that threshold, I no longer felt beholden to the thoughts of other people. I was brought into a place of just intuitive generosity and wonder and curiosity and wanting to know so much more than I previously knew. I mean, I'm an educated person. I don't know everything, but my hunger for more knowledge, my hunger for more collaboration, whatever I mean by that, I don't necessarily know if that shows up in my actual work, but it definitely shows up like in my social life. It definitely shows up in the conversations I want to have and where I show up when people ask me to be someplace. I think there's some combination of just voracious inquisitiveness. There's a sense of risk where you just don't give a fuck anymore. But you also have so much more life experience and knowledge, and you know what you deserve as a person. And I think when we're talking about wetness on this record, I think when we're talking about this sort of new sexual place she's in, when we're talking about this expansive idea of gender when it comes to her that seems new. And I would also argue that she's been on this trajectory for a while with this gender question, right? I mean, I think that one of her more interesting phases was intersecting with Gaga on Telephone, right? Where at that point, Gaga was the most interesting person in American popular music. And Beyonce at that point was not. And I think that like the Freaky Friday element of those two people is something I want to just bring into the room and just leave it because we won't have time to get into it. But I think that Beyonce is 40 years old. I think she's going to turn 41 in a month. I think just something happens when you reach this milestone that society, especially I think if you're a woman identified person, there's so much pressure to like get everything done before this age. And then you get to it and it's like, oh, wait, I woke up today. I'm still here. And all my body parts still work. And I can have an orgasm if that's what we're talking about here. I am obsessed with the idea of love coming down. And her love has come down on this album is what I would say.
Since you brought up Gaga, I just want to make sure that Beyonce is not doing Uncle Johnny like Gaga did Joanne. That's all I'm going to say.
Wow.
Because,
wow. Yeah. I just want to make sure because when Gaga goes to tell Joanne's sister in the documentary that she's made this album about her and the sister looks at her like, what the hell are you talking about? That's something to be avoided.
I don't know. That's a point.
Well, I think she's been very clear. I mean, when she got, was it the GLAAD Award a couple of years ago?
Yeah, in 2019. Yep.
Yeah, and she gave the speech and she started crying. I too had an uncle who died of AIDS-related illnesses. And so when she talks up in that speech and she starts crying and she's like talks about him dying and watching him die. I mean, I think there's something that's really powerful about making this album for, you know, because the real subtext here is that as much as it's about freedom, the times that she's both looking back on politically in the time in which the album is produced are really, you have to create this music in spite of what's happening. And so I think it's really beautiful gesture in a lot of ways, but she's also claiming lineage. And I want to say that. The other thing I want to say, and this is like super heteronormative to say, but I also think as a mother of two children and Beyonce is a mother of three children, to be like this highly sexual being, like after going through that process, our good friend Robin Givain wrote a really great piece in the Washington Post about the various leotards that Beyonce is wearing with the album in terms of the promotional materials. But she's also that song Cozy, the way that she's so comfortable in her skin. I mean, when I heard that and I was like, and you see her and she's a different body. She's a different person. She is, like Wesley's saying, like on the verge of 41, but also have gone through so many transformations that we've seen publicly. It was really nice to see. And I feel like I'm just like oozing, right? Like wetness, oozing with excitement here. Yeah, I thought that was also powerful. Like I was like, oh, she's just kind of, I mean, you know, Beyonce has all this stuff to help her be who she is, but she does look different. And I think she's celebrating her womanness, her grown up womanness once again. And we're part of that journey with her.
To circle back to something you were mentioning a moment ago, I can't help but think of America Has a Problem. Wesley, would you mind if I read your little bit about America Has a Problem from your review? Do you want to read it?
No, I don't have it. You can go.
Okay, this is Wesley's. Wesley Morris on America Has a Problem. Shout out Kilo Ali. first of all. Were I that musician, now might be the time to call my freestyle jam America Has a Problem and not say what the problem is. Because A, psych. B, what am I saying that you already know? And C, the person actually performing this song knows that booty gonna do what it want to. Right? I thought that this was like such a great distillation and actually a really great rejoinder to the kind of complicated discourse around Break My Soul and the Great Resignation and the can you dance through the collapse of American exceptionalism.
I mean,
and yada, yada,
y'all
yada.
Need to, like, give me a break, America. Gee, I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
But this ties to what you were saying a moment ago, Wesley, which is just like you hit a certain age, right? And you're going to express your frustrations, your desires, your needs, your curiosities the way that you need to.
Yes.
And that's what this is. That's what this is. And that's what this song is. That's what this paragraph about that song is. Salamisha, that's exactly what you're talking about with the wetness.
Can I pull back the curtain for a second on what it's like to cover a Beyoncé album? Because I think the America Has a Problem part of it is really funny, right? So
yes.
Right, yeah. The track list comes out, right? And you see that Beyoncé has a song called America Has a Problem. And your first thought is like, oh man, like this is it. This is like Black Panther Beyoncé. Like, here we go. Like,
it's
let's
like
do this, right?
Like,
yes. Exactly. Yeah. And you start scrambling, right? As a newspaper that covers Beyoncé heavily.
That's what we do.
You start scrambling and you say, all right, what are we going to do with Beyonce's political anthem? And then you see the lyrics and you see that Atlanta bass legend pioneer Kilo is sampled, right? And then immediately you think, okay, Kilo also has a song called America Has a Problem, but it's about cocaine. And it's frankly, it's a conscious rap bass song from 1990, early 90s. And then your brain is scrambled and you're like, what is Beyonce going to do here? And then you turn it on and all she's going to do is talk about her wetness and drugs, but not in the way that Kilo Ali was. So I loved that fake out. And I love that Wesley called out the fake out and almost pretty much led his review with it.
I feel like we should go. I just checked on eBay. I believe that the Kilo Ali t-shirt that I have been following on eBay has been purchased, unfortunately. I was going to say it'd be nice if someone got that for me. There's another Kilo, like a tank top. I don't know if I like this one as much as the one that appears to be gone. I'm very frustrated. Someone got a hold of the Beyonce credits and just got on eBay and scooped it up. So anyway, salute to that person. Thanks to everybody. This is one hell of a talk. Joe Coscarelli, John Perales, Salamisha Tillett, Wesley Morris. That is our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook. Get in the Discord, tinyurl.com/podcastdiscord. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with your Beyonce sidebars, tangents, takes, and feels. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer on this Sunday night, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. America Has a Problem and Beyonce is gonna dance about it. Let's listen to it. See you next week. Now come and get 2040, 80 at the trap. Hit it with the rap.